Hello, and welcome to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and I'm especially delighted that today our guest author is Ellie Griffiths, whose new book is The Locked Room. She has won the Edgar Award, the Mary Higgins Clark Award, the Crime Writers Association's Dagger in the Library Award. So it's not just me that recognizes her books. There's a lot of other people out there that are big fans. Before we begin our chat, I do want to pause for just a minute, let those listening in know that the Poison Pen does have copies of The Locked Room, as well as Ellie's earlier books, and we would be delighted to hold one or put one in the mail to you. All you need to do is give us a call at the Poison Pen or go online and we can make that happen. And I would like to welcome in one of my favorite authors, Ellie Griffiths.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
Oh, thank you. I always am fascinated by how authors get to where they're at, so I'd like to know who they were before they started writing. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, yes. So I really was one of those people who always wanted to write. I wrote my first full-length book when I was 11, and it was called The Hair of the Dog. Which must have been something my parents talked about at home. I don't know. But, you know, it's the phrase that means, you know, if you drunk a lot the night before, then if you have a drink the next day, you feel better. But yeah. I don't think I understood that. I think I just thought it was quite a nice phrase about revenge, really. And it was set in Ruttingdean, which is the village near where I live now, actually, just outside Brighton. So I always wanted to write. And I don't know if you, I know you know, but people might not know that my real name is Domenica De Rosa. My dad was Italian, and I've got such a romantic writery name, and I do think that kind of influenced me. You know, I thought I could just imagine myself doing that signature, you know, with a big D and the big R. Of course, it's ironical that I never do that signature now, but I think it might have influenced, you know, wanting to be a writer. But when I was at secondary school, I used to write little Starsky and Hutch stories for my friends, I used to write those little episodes, you know, just longhand, and so my school friends would ask me every week, you know, I've got a new episode. And I remember one week I killed off Starsky, which you know, was really sad. Yeah. I know, but he was my favorite, you know. And I just do remember that when it was passed around in class, some people cried. And I kind of liked that. And I guess it made me think that I sort of was learning how to do that, really. How to, it's just the order in which you put words on the page, isn't it? It's very strange, but it can make people laugh. It can make them cry. And I think that was my first sort of clue that I might be able to do that. But really, I didn't have then a very straightforward route to being a writer. I read English at university. Then I worked in a library for a while in London. And then I went to work for a publishing company, went to work for HarperCollins, who, funny enough, published me in the US now. And I was a publicity assistant first, but then I kind of ended up being an editor and eventually an editorial director at HarperCollins. So I was working on children's books and I loved it. But I'd kind of forgotten that I wanted to write a book. So it wasn't till I was on maternity leave, and I've got twins who are 24, rather to my amazement, but I have got twins who are 24. So this must have been, I guess, 25 years ago, I was on maternity leave, and I kind of remembered, oh, I actually want to write a book. And I didn't finish it on maternity leave. I think the twins are about four, but that eventually became my first published book.
Let's talk a little bit about your new book, The Locked Room. It's part of your Ruth Galloway series. What can you tell readers about it?
So this is number 14 in the Dr. Ruth Galloway series. And I'm so grateful, by the way, to Poison Pen, who have supported the series right from the very beginning, right from the first one, which is The Crossing Places. So I'm really grateful to that for that. So this is book number 14. Now, I had a bit of a decision to make with this book. So the book before it's 13, and it's called The Nighthawks, and it ends in December 2019. So I had to make a pretty quick decision, really, when starting the next one as to whether I was going to cover 2020, lockdown, COVID, that situation, really. Whether, I mean, I know that lots of writers will pretend We'll write about 2020 as if it didn't happen, and that's not wrong at all. And I had to make that decision quite quickly, and I decided in the end that because I'd written a book about Ruth every year for the last 14 years, it sort of felt almost wrong to leave it out. I don't know. So I did decide to do that. So the book starts in February 2020. There's just little glimmerings of this thing called COVID-19. Nelson, DCI Nelson, the policeman, is busy stomping around saying it's all made up. But Cathbad, the druid, character is putting a circle of protection around his house, and Ruth finds a photograph of her cottage in Norfolk, and the strange thing is it's in her dead mother's belongings, but it's dated 1963, which is before Ruth was born. So Ruth wonders why her mother had a photograph of her cottage from before Ruth was born. So that's a mystery that Ruth has to solve. Nelson, on the other hand, is trying to solve a series of murders that look like suicides, and they're sort of so-called locked room murders. And then before they can go much further, COVID happens, lockdown happens. It seemed to happen very quickly, didn't it? And they're all locked down in their houses, so they're all in locked rooms. And oh, it's lucky that Ruth has got a lovely new neighbour, or is it? That's all I'm going to say.
To be honest, I didn't really tie the title into COVID and being locked in. I was thinking more you were referencing your love of classic British mysteries and the locked room, because there is kind of another mystery there that ties into that.
Definitely, and definitely I was. Yes, obviously, you know, crime writers love the whole sort of locked room trope, you know, the so-called impossible crime, the impossible murder in a locked room. Yes, and I've always wanted to write one of those books. So there is a death in the book, which is in a locked room. But I did also want to sort of make it a bit wider and just think about everybody being locked away, you know, in their own locked room. And home became very important. But also, as one of the sort of threads in the book goes, sometimes people were locked down with people who were dangerous to them. I wanted to cover that as well. So many ways in which one could be sort of locked away. An old-fashioned locked room murder mystery, but also kind of for our times, because you've got COVID, you've got lockdown in other ways as well.
I guess they would say in Britain, you're such a clever clogs for on so many different levels. But
that's so lovely of you to say, and such a great typically English phrase as well.
One of the things I find fascinating about Ruth is how she came to you as a character. If I understand correctly, it was while you were with your husband.
Yes. So, so I was saying that I wrote my first book, but that was under my own name, Domenica De Rosa. So I wrote about four kind of stories that are sort of romances, family saga-y sort of stories. But then my husband, Andy, changed careers. So he'd been a lawyer, but he'd always wanted to be an archaeologist. So he changed his career to be an archaeologist. And one day we were walking across this marshland in North Norfolk. Have you ever visited Norfolk?
I have not.
You should go. It's a very beautiful, very historic part of England. It's right on the east coast there. And it's very beautiful, but also parts of it are quite bleak, you know, because it's very flat and there's marshland and sand dunes and sea. So we're walking across this land, and Andy said that prehistoric people had thought marshland was sacred. Because it's neither land nor sea, but something in between, they thought of it as a bridge to the afterlife. Neither land nor sea, neither life nor death. And as soon as he said that, the whole idea for the crossing places came to me, really. And I did see Ruth Galloway walking towards me. She was walking towards me out of the mist. I know it sounds a bit far-fetched, but she really did kind of appear in front of me. And I thought I knew everything about her in that instant, really.
Each of your Ruth Galloway books is kind of tied into some type of archaeological find or theory or historical fact. Was that planned, or did you just kind of fall into that?
Yes, I did sort of plan to have each one cover both an archaeological case or a discovery, excavation, and a murder. So the first one is a real life Bronze Age henge that was found on the North Norfolk coast, and that's linked into cases of missing children. The second one is about Roman remains, and the third one is about Second World War remains. And that is the wonderful thing, I think it is something, this wasn't planned, but it's just sort of happened, is writing about an archaeologist means that you can sort of roam across the centuries, really, the millennia almost. So it does kind of stop you, keeps you fresh, I think. And each one is really different because, so I've had King Arthur and I've had Victorian murderesses and I've had, you know, Bronze Age, Iron Age, Roman remains. And so that does keep it, for me anyhow, fresh. And so the most recent one, The Locked Room, starts with Ruth excavating what turns out to be a medieval skeleton, which is thought to be a plague victim. And of course, then you've got the link there, the parallel between the plague, which happened very virulently in Norwich, the capital of Norfolk, twice in the 1300s and in the 1500s. So you've got that link there between the plague and COVID. And I, you know, the other wonderful thing is you do find out all these interesting things. So when I was researching the plague in Norwich, I found they did have these people called watchers, yeah. And they carried these long poles, which may have been 2 meters long, I don't know, but they were to check that people socially distanced, that they kept apart. So, you know, all those things are very, very interesting. So I guess I didn't quite plan it the way it's been, but it has for me sort of kept it fresh. I mean, I've got to say, sometimes it is quite difficult to link, you know, a Bronze Age discovery with a modern murder, but so far I've managed it.
It was really interesting because I guess being from America, I didn't have that perspective of the Middle Ages and Black Death and all. We were thinking of 1917 and the Spanish influenza things, but it's both old and new in many ways.
It is definitely. And the idea of sort of isolating and cutting yourself off and to save others as well was very prevalent in those times. And you have the terrible stories of whole villages actually really nobly just isolate themselves. Everyone dies, but they don't pass it on. So yes, you know, that was really interesting. But the Spanish flu is interesting, you know, as you were mentioning, 1917, because I found out quite recently that very few novels of the time wrote about the Spanish flu. And I don't know why. I mean, obviously you can read about it in historical books, but then very few fictional accounts of it. So I'm sort of glad that me and quite a number of other fellow crime writers like Catherine Ryan Howard and Peter May have chosen to write about COVID. So at least there will be some fictional accounts of it.
I know as an author, you draw upon real historical sources, but you also have to use your creative powers in storytelling. Was the Grey Lady real, or was that something you came up with?
No, the Grey Lady is real. Well, I guess I guess she's as real as a ghost can be. No, she is real, and she is a very sad spirit, really, that haunts Tombland, which again is a real place. Isn't that a great name, though?
Yeah, it is.
It's the name for the area around the cathedral in Norwich. And rather disappointingly, it comes from an old English word meaning empty space. Wow. But of course, Tombland is perfect, isn't it? So yes, and she and her family were locked up during the plague, and they had the plague. So actually what happened was you were basically sealed into your house. And I think they wrote, "God have mercy on your soul," on the door, and you were locked in to die. And when they opened the house after the plague had finished, the outbreak had finished, they found the three dead bodies, the girl and her parents. But it was thought that the girl had tried to eat her parents' flesh to stay alive. It's a horrible story. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that, she haunts Tombland. But actually, I have a little family link with this story, because my grandfather was an actor, and he's the part of the inspiration for my other series, that the Magic Men books, you know, about actors in the vaudeville actors in the 1950s. So, but my granddad was appearing in Norwich, and one night he was going home through Tombland, and he was following this figure of a woman with a long grey coat. And I guess in this time, I don't know when it would have been, but long coats weren't so unusual. Or maybe he thought she was just from the theatre or something. She was walking in front of him. And then she turned and seemed to go into a doorway. And then when my granddad got to where she turned off, the doorway wasn't there. But he said the thing that really made him think was when he got home, he realised that her long skirt had made no noise on the fallen leaves.
Wow.
So I wonder if he saw the Grey Lady of Tombland.
That's just fascinating. Another thing I love about your Ruth Galloway books is how ideally situated she is to be an amateur sleuth as an archaeologist, because the jobs in many ways are similar. You're digging up bodies, in a sense, you're sifting through evidence and clues.
I think that's something that really struck me when Andy became an archaeologist, and he introduced me to a wonderful woman who's helped me a lot with the books, called Lucy Sibben, who is an actual forensic archaeologist, and who really are called upon by the police when they find buried bodies. And the way that an archaeologist, or any archaeologist, kind of reads the landscape, and they look at sort of dips in the landscape, they look at the foliage, they look at what grows there, you know, they can really pick up those clues. So it is so similar to the way a detective works. And I thought it would be really interesting to juxtapose Ruth with DCI Nelson, who because they do a similar job, but from different perspectives. So Ruth is an academic, and she says at one point that the questions are more important than the answers. So she's always asking questions, whereas Nelson is very much, he's a police officer, he wants to find out who did it, he wants to do it quickly, he's quite impatient. So he's coming at it from a different angle, but they are quite similar, and they're very methodical. They both like lists, they both like, and they both work very carefully when they get to a site, because it's so fascinating to hear any forensic specialist talk about how they treat a site, and how every contact leaves a trace and all those things. But that's true even if a body's been dead for 2,000 years. So it is. I really find the similarities very interesting. And of course, archaeologists quite often have to make up a story, like the famous sort of bog bodies, like Lindau Man. I think the poor guy was strangled, garrotted, poisoned, and then stabbed. You know, that's a murder case, if you like. We don't know why, but that is a murder.
Now, in addition to Ruth's work, you talked about police work. I'm sure you have your contacts there too. Did they tell you how things had changed for them during COVID? Because
Yes, definitely. So I have a police advisor called Graham Bartlett, who also advises another local author to me called Peter James. I'm sure you know Peter James. And in fact, Graham, I should say, has just had his own book out. I think it's due to come out. It's called Bad for Good. It's very, very good. So Graham was the chief superintendent of Brighton and Hove. So he's perfectly placed to advise. But I have to say he's very kind, because quite often I want to stretch the truth a little bit. I think Peter's very good about sticking to procedure. And I'll say to Graham, I really want this to happen. And he says, well, it's a bit unlikely, but I think Nelson would stretch the rules and do that. So he's very kind to advise me. But yes, he talked a lot, because although he's retired, his son had actually recently become a police officer during COVID. So actually he finished his training during COVID. And so Graham was very interesting. And one of the terrible things really that he told me about lockdown was that the very early people to put on PPE and masks were criminals, you know, oh, particularly drug dealers. And, you know, you weren't meant to be driving around and you know, people stopping you if you were doing that, but not if you were wearing, you know, medical clothes and a mask. And the drug dealers were very, very quick to do that. So I thought that does come into the book. And also, again, you know, he was saying about the fact that, you know, cases of domestic violence did rise terribly during that time, and that is something else that comes into my book.
Landscape is very important in your books, the setting. It's almost a character in itself. Can you talk a little bit of, I mean, you have your Ruth Galloway books, we'll talk a little bit about your other series, The Magic Man, which is Brighton. How important to you as a writer is landscape or setting?
It's really important. It's really important. And usually with the Ruth books, the book starts with the place. You know, I was saying about the inspiration for the crossing places being that marshland, that liminal zone, that sort of very flat landscape between life and death almost. So it is usually a place. Like, for example, the Ghost Fields, which I think is book 7, which is about the abandoned air bases in Norfolk. That happened just when I was driving through Norfolk one day, and I passed an old abandoned airfield, and next to it was a pub, and the pub was called the Hourglass. And I thought, how awful, really, to be going to an airbase, to be going up in a plane, not knowing if you're going to come back. And the pub was called the Hourglass, like the sands of time, sort of drink. Rather disappointingly, I found out that actually during the war, it had been called the Horse and Groom, but they'd kept the H&G, so actually it wasn't called the Hourglass then. But it was just that sense of, you know, I could just imagine going from the airfield. So that whole, that little sort of instant of seeing that. I was driving. I think I did stop and took a picture or something, but then I sort of drove off. That really gave me the whole idea for the book. So it, for those books, particularly the Ruth books, it really often is a place. And one of the inspirations for The Locked Room is a real place in Tombland called Steward's House, which is a very beautiful, really, Tudor building, but it's one of those Tudor buildings that looks, there's not a straight line in it, it's all sort of skewed and strange, and it has quite an interesting history. What I didn't know was that now it's actually, they actually use it for panic room parties, where you can have parties where you get, you know, there's, I've never been to one, I don't know if you have, I don't think I'd like one, where you have to go and sort of solve the clues. I wish I'd known that for the book, because that's so perfect, really.
Yeah, it is. You're one of those rare authors that not only have one successful series, you have a second, The Magic Men. Can you tell those listening in today a little bit about that series?
Yes, so The Magic Men is a series. It starts in 1950, and the first book is The Zigzag Girl. And it starts when a detective called Edgar Stevens, who, funny enough, you know, I was talking about my book that I wrote when I was 11. The main character in that was called Edgar Stevens. Obviously, I really like the name. I don't know why. Anyhow, so he's called Edgar Stevens, and he finds the body of a woman cut into three. Now, I have to say just right out there that my books are not gory, or, and I don't like describing bloodshed or violence very much. So it's not a gory description, but it is quite a gory thing to happen. So he finds the body of a woman cut into three, and it reminds him of that trick that magicians do. You know, when the, I'm afraid it almost always is a woman, goes into a cabinet, and then the magician puts those swords through and pulls out the middle bit, so it looks like a zigzag. And it reminds Edgar of the somebody who served within the war, who was a magician called Max Mephisto, and they solve the case together. And really the inspiration for this book was I was saying earlier, my grandfather, who was a comedian called Dennis Laws. And he was part of this world, this vaudeville world, where you traveled around the country and you were on a different show every night. And it was like a sort of, you know, variety show, you know, like Britain's Got Talent or something. So there would be a comedian on the bill, but they might be a sword swallower or a dance act or a ventriloquist. So it was a really mixed show. And quite often it was a magician. And there was a particular magician that my grandfather was often on the bill with. And he was called Jasper Maskelyne, which I do think is a great name. But he was really famous between the wars. And during when the Second World War came, Churchill asked Jasper Maskelyne to put together a group of magicians to use stage magic in the war effort, you know, to use things like camouflage or misdirection or those sort of tricks, really. And they did things like they created dummy tanks and dummy soldiers. You know, I was talking about the air bases before. They created these dummy air bases that from the sky looked real. And so this was such an interesting backstory that I decided to give that to my character Max Mephisto. So he has served in a group that I've called the Magic Men during the war, with Edgar, and so that they get together to solve crime. So the first one set in 1950, and the most recent one is the Midnight Hour, which is set in, it brings the story right up to 1965. So that's series, which has been a lot of fun to write.
It's also especially, I think, brilliant on your part too. You have an archaeologist that ties to detection. You have a magician who knows how things can be misdirected, how people can not be seeing what's really there. So once again, it's almost like a perfect parallel to finding the truth as a detective.
Oh, thank you. One of the things that really interests me actually was how similar in some ways a magician structures his tricks in the way that a writer would structure a book, you know, because you have the build up and you have you sort of introduce the characters. The magician tries to get a rapport with the audience, and so you like him, and then you have the jeopardy, you know, that you show maybe a cabinet with spikes in or something, so you're raising the jeopardy, and then you do a bit of misdirection. You kind of say, well, look over there, and quite often with a magician it's, you know, scantily clad women appear and look what's happening, don't look here, this that's happening, and then you have the thing that happens, that the lady disappears or the man gets cut in two, and then you know, then you have the reveal as to how it's done. So all that, you know, it is really interesting the way that it is structured. And I think it has, in my mind, you know, it's quite often think of that when I'm writing. I think, you know, oh, we've had the first trick, maybe we need the second trick now, maybe we need a bit of misdirection. So it is, and I teach creative writing, and sometimes I with my students, we watch a magic trick, say on YouTube or something, and we break it down as to how it's done and try and do that in our writing, you know, try and use that sort of structure, because it is very interesting how similar it is.
Well, I think I've heard somewhere that she said, to paraphrase, that there's kind of a contract between the writer, the crime fiction writer, and the reader, because there's that shared interest at arriving at the conclusion.
Absolutely, yes. And one of the things I love about crime fiction is for the reader, it's very active, isn't it? It's not a passive reading. And I'm sure, you know, you're the same, because you're passionate about crime fiction, and your readers are too. You know, it's not a passive reading, it's an active reading. So you are quite involved, I think, with the author. And I think there is a contract in a way, because you trust the writer to give you all the clues, you know, and in the right order, really. So that you can solve it. Of course, the writer's going to make it difficult for you, because otherwise it wouldn't be fun. But I think at the end, well, my editor and I've been very lucky, because I've had the same editor called Jane Wood. She's amazing for all my Ellie Griffiths books. And she always says that when you're about sort of 10 pages from the end or something, by then the reader should know who did it. So the reader finds out at the moment the detective does the reveal. You know, if it was Agatha Christie, we went, Hercule Poirot gets everyone in the library and says, oh, I'm going to tell you who the murderer is. Sorry for my bad Belgian accent, but you know the sort of thing. So you should sort of arrive at it at the same time. And there's a brilliant quote, which I'm going to misquote, I think, but it's sort of this. It's Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey, and she says, the reader can tell by the telltale diminution of the pages that we're hastening together towards perfect felicity. So I think that's what we're aiming for, perfect felicity.
That's a wonderful apropos quote. I think you're right, too. I think for crime fiction, mystery readers, you mentioned Agatha Christie. I think her brilliance, and I think you kind of are striving towards this, is even if you think in a Christie book you've solved it, you're not mad when she reveals it, because the clues were there. She just misdirected you.
Exactly. And you can go back, can't you? And it's sort of retrospectively cursive, it all kind of links up. And yes, you're exactly right. I'm often fooled by her. And even though now I've read all her books at least once, I quite often reread them and I think, oh, yes, I am fooled again. But you don't mind, because she has put it all there. And even, even on this podcast, I'm not going to do spoilers, but, you know, the murder of Roger Ackroyd, that's so clever. But when you read back, there's not, you know, it's all there. She's not cheated once. And so I think that is what makes you feel, because, you know, I'm one of 12 writers who have been asked, such an honor to write a new Miss Marple story.
Oh, that's coming this fall. I did not
know. Yeah, it's coming this fall. Yeah, oh. I think it's on Agatha Christie's birthday, which I think is 15th of September, around then, anyhow.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait for you to read it, actually, because it's so fun. So it's me, Jean Kwok, Naomi Alderman, Val McDermott, Ruth Ware, Drita St. Mitchell. So there's some great writers there and such different stories. But when I was asked to do this, the Agatha Christie estate really kindly gave us all the Miss Marple books to read. And I can imagine what fun that was. But I was just struck by how clever she is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she does lead you along there. And they're not very long books. There's not much padding there. I'm still amazed. And some little phrases, like I think in one of them, it's Miss Marple's described as nemesis in a pink shawl. And, you know, you just think that's just perfect. It's just perfect.
Yeah, she really was. I mean, you understand why she was called the Queen of Crime, rightly so. In addition to your two series, you've written a couple of, we'll call them standalone novels, The Stranger Diaries and The Postscript Murders. They were both fascinating in their own way, I think, because it allowed you to kind of almost pay homage or indulge in your own love of Victorian literature, of Golden Age mysteries. And you talk about setting being a bridge in the case between the past and the present, and In these books, you also offer readers a bridge between those fictional worlds and today, too.
Well, that's a wonderful way of putting it. But yes, they were so much fun to write because, as you say, it does give you a bit of freedom. And Stranger Diaries was meant to be a standalone, but the detective, Harbinder Kaur, seemed to have popped up again in Postscript Murders, and she's going to appear again in a new book, Bleeding Heart Yard, out later this year. But yes, so I've always loved, so the Stranger Diaries is kind of sort of Victorian Gothic. I did a master's in Victorian literature. I love that sort of thing. So it did allow me to, there's a kind of mock Gothic short story that runs mm-hmm. through it, and a lot of the tropes, but brought up to date because it's set in a modern school, but one that was sort of owned by a man who was well known for a Gothic short story. So yes, I had lots of fun with that, and actually it's really good fun because after you've written about a character in a series for a long time, of course they're the ultimate reliable narrator. We sort of trust Ruth, we trust what she says, you know, we trust Max and Edgar as well in the Magic Men books, but you know, when you start with a new character, well, we don't know whether to trust them or not, and that's so much fun for a writer. Yes, and in Postscript Murders, it's modern day, and it's the main character's kind of slightly based on my Aunt Marge, actually, because my Aunt Marge moved to a sort of retirement home on the South Coast. And I don't know what it was about living, so it was a really lovely, it is a really lovely flat, and it looks out over the sea and the promenade there, but something about it, I don't know what it was, sea air, I don't know, but it made Marge really obsessed with murder, and she kept thinking of these murder plots and ringing me up and saying, oh love, you know, I've thought of a good way to murder a vicar, do you want to hear it? And I'd say, oh yes, please. So I thought, what if there was an elderly lady, my Marge is very respectable, retired teacher, you know, what if there was an elderly lady and her job was making up murders for crime writers? So that's the kind of basis for Postscript Murders, but it did allow me to sort of have a lot of fun with these golden age mysteries, and again I made up a golden age writer, and I used up all those titles that my publishers would never let me have, because I really love Shakespearean titles, so things like The Prince of Darkness is a Gentleman and The Sleeping and the Dead, you know, I would really like to use those, so I think I've used them all up in her made-up book. So yes, lots of fun, and the new one is Bleeding Heart Yard, and it features Harbinder again, and it's slightly different in that she's moved to London and she's with the Met, but then a prominent politician is found dead in a real life place called Bleeding Heart Yard, so that was a lot of fun too.
Oh, good heavens. I might get it slightly off, but you had written something in The Locked Room about how terribly soothing it is to read crime novels during troubled times. Do you think that's why we've kind of seen almost this renaissance of interest in crime fiction?
Yes, yeah, I do really. Yes, and I thought that when I was writing that, really, because she wrote that book a little after lockdown, and I found that in myself. You know, I found it really soothing to reread Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, big fan of Nancy Spain and writers like that. And what is it? I don't know. I think maybe because in a crime novel there is jeopardy, but there is also a resolution and things are restored to normal, and sometimes it's done through unconventional ways. So mm-hmm. Agatha Christie's two most successful popular books are And When There Were None and Murder on the Orient Express, where justice is dealt out mm-hmm. very fairly, really, but by unconventional means. So I think those things we do find comforting, you know, and a recurring character, like I'm a big fan of, you know, Hank Leaves and Vera. And when you sort of reading and Vera appears, you think, oh, great, you know, everything's okay, Vera's going to sort it out. So I think there is, you know, there's the soothing quality of a long running series, you know, like Ian Rankin, Rebus. I love Rebus almost more now he's old and grumpy and can't walk very far. So, you know, I love that about that. So I think there is something soothing. I don't know if it's a particular British and American thing, but there's something very soothing about our crime fiction, because there is usually a resolution and some sort of justice at the end. So I think we did turn to that, didn't we? I don't know if you found yourself reading old favourites during that time, but I certainly did.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think it's the idea that what you're going through in the real world you can find comfort in seeing things do play out well, even if it's just in a book. And I think the same thing happened during World War II to some degree. I know in Great Britain, Agatha Christie was incredibly popular. In the US, even the president was reading mystery novels, Franklin Roosevelt. So there's something about the hope, I guess, the hope of that it delivers.
I think that's so true. And yes, you're absolutely right, wasn't it? That was the golden age, really, sort of between the wars, and we were all a bit worried about the international situation. Perhaps the fact that you can find a resolution, you can solve things, is very, very comforting, isn't it? And I think also in the 1920s, a lot of those crime writers wrote rules, didn't they? Mm-hmm. You know, like Knox's famous Ten Commandments. And maybe they were trying to make sense and trying to say, look, these are the rules, we have to stick by them. I don't know, but those sort of famous rules of crime fiction, which everyone breaks all the time, mm-hmm. like, you know, no undiscovered poison and mm-hmm. no secret passages. But I wonder if that was an attempt to sort of impose order on it all.
I think that's very perceptive. You've been an editor, you have taught writing in addition to being a writer yourself. For people out there that are working on their first writing project, hope to be writers, what's the best piece of advice you'd give them?
Well, it sounds slightly obvious, but it really would be just to start writing. And I think the thing is, Picasso, I think, said, I'm quoting all these people today, I might have got them all wrong, but I think he said, the muse catches you working. And I think, don't wait till you have a brilliant idea. Don't wait till you've worked out the plot. Don't wait. Just start writing. You know, if you're listening to this, start writing tonight. Go and sit at your computer or open your notebook and just see what comes out. Because I think, you know, writing comes from writing. So if you just start something, I think that's, and try and finish it, even if it's just finish the chapter, because that will give you, again, some sort of resolution. So really, it would be just to start writing. Don't take too much. I mean, I'm saying this, somebody teach creative writing, but don't ask for too much advice from your friends and family. I wouldn't, because you can get too many voices, especially when you're starting out, saying, oh, I like this, I like that character, should be first person, should be third person. I would just see where it takes you and just enjoy it, really enjoy it. It's so much fun. And, you know, I certainly sympathize with people who are starting out, but in another way, how lovely it is to be starting out and you've got as much time as you like to write your first book and you can do what you like. Oh, it's so much fun. So just enjoy it.
I think that's wonderful advice. I'd never heard the Picasso quote. The one that I often hear, I think, is from Nora Roberts, which is, you can fix a bad page, but you can't fix a blank page. So you have to put something
in. I love that one as well. Yeah, just have a page, have a manuscript, because then you know, absolutely, as that says, you can then go back and edit it. But you need something there. You need something to edit. That's a wonderful quote.
Before we run out of time and it's flown by, you've
made... It really has.
Well, you're just an absolute delightful guest. You've mentioned what's coming. Can you remind us? I'm thrilled that you're in the Miss Marple anthology. I can't wait for that. But what's next for you, for Ruth and for the Magic Men?
So the next the Magic Men book that I think you've had is The Midnight Hour. So that's the last one of that. So, and of course, The Locked Room comes out on the 28th, isn't it? The 28th of June in the US. And I'm so sorry you've had to wait, but I really hope you enjoy it. So the next thing after that will be Bleeding Heart Yard, which will be in the fall. I'm not entirely sure of the date, I should know. But anyhow, I think it's around October. And just before then, you'll have the Miss Marple anthology, which I think is just called Marple. So I'm not sure Miss Marple would like just being called Marple, but anyhow, that's out in September. Then there's Bleeding Heart Yard, and next spring there'll be Ruth 15, which I'm writing now, which is called The Last Remains. And my publishers are working quite hard to try and get the pub date closer to the UK one, so you don't have to wait so long. So that will be next spring. I'm not entirely sure when.
This is a perfect segue for me to say to those listening in that the Poison Pen is very fortunate. We do get your British editions.
Oh, editions, you do, yes.
Yeah, so for readers like myself that can't wait, you know, you may pay a little bit more, but it's worth it in the end. So you can always look for the British editions of the Poison Pen if you can't wait to get your Ellie Griffiths reading fill.
You're so supportive. Thank you very much.
Before we end, how can readers find out more about you and your books? Are you on social media? Do you have a website?
Yeah, I have a website, elliegriffiths.co.uk. I'm also on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Facebook, and I love hearing from people. So, please get in contact. On my Facebook page, I often do things like read books aloud, read chapters aloud, and things like that, have discussions. So that's all fun. And yes, I say I'm on Twitter and I'm on Instagram. So please get in contact. I absolutely love hearing from readers, and I really do appreciate you. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank Ellie Griffiths for taking time to visit with us, and thank those tuning in. This has been another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. We look forward to seeing you all next time.
Thank you so much.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.